From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Coming this fall, the White House will have more control over efforts to shape America's image abroad. The Bush administration announced this week the creation of a permanent Office of Global Communications, expanded from the campaign to counter anti-American sentiment in Afghanistan during the fighting there. The move comes amid rumblings in the White House and Congress for a complete overhaul of the ways America attempts to win over the hearts and minds of foreigners. The Council on Foreign Relations released a well-timed report this week suggesting several reforms in U.S. public diplomacy. Joining us now is David Morey, co-chair of the task force responsible for that report. David, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to get to a number of your recommendations, but first, tell me what you found out about how the citizens of other countries view the United States. Some of the adjectives within your report are arrogant, self-indulgent, hypocritical, inattentive, unwilling or unable to engage in cross-cultural dialogue.
We have a real challenge. There's an awful lot of mischaracterization of America out in the various parts of the world. But across the board, America is perceived to not have empathy. And by the way, it's not just in the Middle East. It's in other regions in the world. It's even represented by misunderstandings between ourselves and our allies.
All right, there's the context. What grade would you give America's public diplomacy campaign to date?
It's not a good grade. We began to disassemble public diplomacy throughout the post-Cold War period over the last 10 years and, in fact, defunded it. You know, we really weren't geared up for the new battle that involves information. So I think, by any measure, public diplomacy is in crisis, or something between crisis and severe challenge. And I think we've got to completely revolutionize the way we look at this.
Your task force report coincided with the announcement from the Bush White House about the establishment of a permanent Office of Global Communications. Do you think that's an important step?
I think this office is a good first step in terms of centralizing strategy near the White House. You know, if you look at a number of policies that the United States has taken over the last several years, Kyoto, the Endite Landmine Treaty, the International Criminal Court, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, agree or disagree with the policies, I think it's clear we could have done a better job at defining the context of those policy decisions. In the case of Kyoto, it positioned the United States as an anti-environmental nation. I think it's much more complicated than that. So we have to be out there aggressively explaining the issues and values behind American policies.
Well, by what mechanisms? It was certainly easy for me to read the administration's rationalizations on Kyoto. Irrespective of whether I agree, all the information is there for me to make a judgment.
You have access to NPR, for example. I mean, a lot of people don't in foreign countries. In Saudi Arabia, for example, 50% of the population is under 20. And of that 50%, those who are exposed to the internet and satellite TV have a 20% higher favorability toward the U.S. Look at some ongoing initiatives that make sense. There's the Radio Sawa, the Middle East Radio Network, which is a $30 million program targeted to youth in the Middle East. That's an excellent example of a program that has been based on research, that has been well thought out strategically, and that will, I think, be part of an ongoing effort to allocate more funds toward television, which is a big part of the battleground here. The idea of putting Secretary Powell on MTV is an excellent idea. That reached into a lot of communities and I think was very effective.
Part of the report focuses on how U.S. officials treat foreign journalists, who I guess get short shrift in official circles. Is that true? Is there a tendency to dismiss foreign journalists as marginal and unimportant?
The report does conclude that we need to do more to increase the service toward foreign journalists. We even thought of an Islamic Press Institute that we may want to look at creation thereof, looking at maybe holding a conference for foreign journalists so that you can get a systemized set of briefings by high-level government officials. We have to do more to provide access and information to foreign journalists because, after all, they are a critical outlet.
Let me tell you something that concerns me. If American politicians cannot explain to their own citizens the rationale behind policy decisions without grossly distorting them the way they do in elections, how in the world can the United States be expected to explain its policy to people who are being propagandized to in Muslim madrasas and elsewhere?
Well, I think you're touching on both the curse and the blessing of the information revolution. You know, we have more information than at any time in history, which necessarily demands that people get more succinct and more effective in the way they communicate because their attention span is diminished. But I think there's some fundamental facts and arguments that can be gotten out into the international community that are helpful to America. And let me give you some examples. How many moderates in Muslim countries think about and understand the last four military interventions that America partook in involved, to some extent, it pursuing and helping Muslim interests? You know, in the case of Somalia, before that Kuwait, the liberation of Kuwait, and the case of Bosnia and Kosovo, you know, the fact that 500 Muslims died in the World Trade Center, the fact that the FBI recently asked for 200 Arabic speakers and 15,000 volunteers came forward. I mean, there's some fundamental facts about Muslim life in America that have to be communicated. And I'm saying we've got to be more creative and yes, more strategic. We've got to even be a little revolutionary the way we think about getting this message across.
All right. David Morey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
David Morey is the co-chair of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force on Public Diplomacy, the founder and CEO of DMG Incorporated, and an adjunct professor of international relations at Columbia University.
There's at least one country in the Middle East that's proven to be a difficult place for the U.S. government to promote America's image. Under Saddam Hussein, Iraq has used its media to isolate its citizens from any views, outside views in particular, in opposition to the current regime. The state-run press is not even reporting leaks in the American press detailing U.S. plans to invade Iraq. Joining us now is Asla Aydin Tashbash, a freelance journalist who writes on Turkey and Iraq. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, could you give us a sense of the media landscape in Iraq? Is there any semblance of an independent press there?
No, not within the government-controlled areas, at least. The state owns most print and broadcast media, and in fact, Saddam Hussein's son, Uday Hussein, is the proud owner of a couple of newspapers.
So no opposition media at all, no radio newspapers or websites run by opponents of Saddam Hussein?
There's actually a really thriving media environment. Not inside the government-controlled areas, but outside in the north, within the confines of the no-fly zone that was established at the end of the Gulf War and safe havens, Kurdish-dominated areas. There is quite a few private television networks run by the two Kurdish groups and also other groups, for example, Turkomans, Assyrians, every minority group. They also have internet access over there, which they don't have in government-controlled areas. One of the main Iraqi opposition groups, Iraqi National Congress, INC, established an opposition television network with U.S. funding not too long ago, about a year ago. And the group has a bitter acrimony with the State Department. The American State Department basically cut off funding and the television has gone off the air. There were some reports, actually, that it was being picked up within the government-controlled areas. One problem is, of course, people don't have satellite dishes. It's not allowed, so it's not easy for people to watch television. Radios are common, though.
So you mentioned radio. Those are probably abundant. Are views in opposition to the government getting through on radio waves?
Definitely, and I think that's one of the most effective ways. According to official figures, there are about 5 million radios in Iraq. That's a country of 22 million, and that's a really high figure. But I don't think people get together, sit around a radio and listen to the BBC. Iraq has become very much a republic of fear in the last two decades, and people really don't want to be very obvious about what they listen to and whether or not they're getting information from outside.
You mentioned Iraq was a republic of fear. I understand that Al Jazeera was banned for more than a week not long ago for not getting Saddam Hussein's title right.
Al Jazeera correspondent in Baghdad was called to the foreign ministry office and told, we are off the air for 10 days, we have banned you, because, well, one reason was that he didn't refer to President Saddam Hussein with his full title, which is actually rather long, and instead President Hussein or the president. And another reason was he didn't refer to the Ba'ath Party as the Arab Socialist Ba'ath Party. He just said the ruling Ba'ath Party. But Iraqis fairly quickly realized that this wasn't a good idea to ban Al Jazeera, which was a very useful tool for the government in getting their message across to Arab audiences. So to sour the relationships with such a key network on such a small matter turned into a big public relations blunder for the government of Iraq.
How are the stories of U.S. military plans to attack Iraq playing in the state-run Iraqi media? Have they even reported the existence of these military documents that lay out various plans to invade Iraq and topple the government?
Well, you wouldn't read in an official Iraqi paper. Yesterday, New York Times reported that U.S. war plans involve special forces going into Baghdad. you would most likely be reading about them in between the lines and in the form of an official Iraqi response. Yesterday, Saddam Hussein said the government is ready, and the head of the Air Force said the military are ready to fight any enemy that might come. It would not be a straightforward news format as we know of it.
And the principal message of the media run by the Iraqi government is, we are ready, bring it on if you dare. But who is that message for?
It's primarily for Pentagon. For example, a meeting with Iraq's top nuclear commission means, you know, you don't know what we might have or we're ready. And
hints of weapons we know nothing of.
Exactly. And in fact, there have been statements by Saddam Hussein's son Uday to that effect last month. And it's also for the larger Arab audience, with the idea that such statements would make Saddam Hussein look courageous and boost his popularity, which is going through the roof in some Arab countries.
Has the opposition Iraqi press in exile or anywhere else reported the leaked U.S. military plans?
They have. They just splash it up on their newspapers. They broadcast it. They put it on websites. There is some sense among the Kurdish groups and other groups that, you know, we're now seeing the fruits of our decade-long lobbying.
Let me just throw in a question with reference to the interview we did at the top of the show. What do you think would be the best way for the U.S. government to win the hearts and minds of Iraqis?
Well, the president has a problem, I think, on this issue. His father, at the end of the Gulf War, delivered a direct speech to the Iraqi population and said, it's time for you to topple your own leader, rise up and get rid of Saddam. And Iraqis did listen to him. Soon after that, the administration decided they were going to let the Iraqi military use air power and helicopters to put down the uprising in 19 of its provinces. Now, President Bush will therefore think twice before making the same mistake. He will not address Iraqi people directly or call on them to topple their leader until he's sure that Saddam is on his way out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Asla Aydin Tashbash is a freelance journalist who contributes regularly to Salon.com, The Wall Street Journal Europe, The New York Times, and Middle Eastern media.
Coming up, the rolling heads of media moguls, quandaries over commercials on September 11th, and the man who made TV possible.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The world's largest media companies are ousting their leaders. Among the most recent, most prominent of the rolling heads are Jean-Marie Messier, CEO of France's Vivendi Universal, Thomas Middelhoff, chief executive of Germany's Bertelsmann, best known as corporate parent of BMG Entertainment, and America's own Robert Pittman, who resigned under pressure as the chief operating officer of AOL Time Warner. Were they all canned for poor corporate management, or were they deep-sixed for reasons that have more to do with the specific national character of their companies? James Surowiecki writes a regular financial column for The New Yorker, and he joins us to talk about these oustings and what the future may hold for mega media. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so Messier and Middelhoff, both European, both out of a job right now. What happened in each of their cases?
Well, in Messier's case, Vivendi ran into a lot of trouble, particularly towards the end of his tenure there. The truth is, relative to most media companies, it wasn't necessarily doing much worse, but its stock price was really being driven down. And in fact, it became clear that the stock was being driven down in part because Messier was running the company. People were skeptical about his strategy for the company, which involved a lot of acquisitions. And the company itself was sort of a strange hodgepodge because, you know, its origins were as a French utility company. And then Messier had kind of remade it, trying to convert it into a media giant, and had done so by buying Universal in the United States and had tried to start this elaborate internet site in Europe. So there were real questions about the validity of this strategy.
Middlehoff's situation seems quite different. He was actually running the company pretty well.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. I mean, Bertelsmann's performance was definitely better than most media companies have been in this kind of an environment. And Bertelsmann had taken a somewhat slow approach to growth, and the acquisitions it had made, you know, seemed to be, for the most part, well done. You know, Middlehoff certainly had a kind of sort of utopian streak if you look at his acquisition of Napster.
Yeah, that was an odd power to the people move there. I guess he went against the grain of the entire recording industry, of which his own company was the biggest part.
Exactly. And it was also sort of difficult from a business perspective to see, you know, what exactly Napster's future was. But the one business part of what Middlehoff was doing that I think raised some concerns within Bertelsmann is that there was some concern that he was spending too much time buying companies and not enough time managing companies.
It's been said about both Messier and Middlehoff that they embraced the American way of business. Is this what raised the hackles of their bosses?
Well, in Messier's case, I think that certainly had an enormous amount to do with what happened to him. You know, Messier was sort of almost excessively American. And in terms of his cultivation of, you know, sort of an American style, he was very flamboyant. He was, you know, appearing in business magazines, and he moved to New York. He said that the French cultural exception, which the French hold quite dear, this idea that there's something unique about French culture, was no longer really valid in today's world. And in every way, he seemed to be sort of moving against the French idea of what business was. In Bertelsmann's case, there's certainly something about Middlehoff cultivating an American style. And you could argue, for example, that, you know, his emphasis on this kind of acquisitive strategy has something to do with that. But with Bertelsmann, the culture is also, to some degree, more company-specific. You know, Bertelsmann was founded as a company that had a social responsibility in its charter. It's a private company, not a public company. Middlehoff wanted to take the company public. So there, I think you have this kind of mix of national cultural issues and then corporate cultural issues.
Let's move to these shores now. AOL's chief operating officer, former Robert Pittman. What happened there?
Well, I think there you're really talking, it's interesting because I think you're again talking about a cultural clash. But in this case, the cultural clash was between Time Warner on one side and AOL on the other. Bob Pittman came in to AOL Time Warner as basically the number two man at AOL, and he was the man who in some ways had really played a key role in turning AOL into this kind of economic powerhouse that everyone thought it was at the end of the 1990s. And what happened was that Pittman, you know, was in theory sort of running the AOL Time Warner on a day-to-day basis, but he had a very hard time unifying the two sides of the company. And he had a very hard time getting people, I think, on the Time Warner side to get on board with his bigger strategy for the company.
Didn't he also just miscalculate when it came to broadband? He couldn't sell it?
I think what Pittman did with broadband was what he did with a lot of things. He overpromised and he underdelivered. So when he came in, he was talking a lot about customers are going to pay $159 a month for cable television, digital cable, you know, digital media, broadband access, blah, 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 blah. And we were a long way away from that 2 years ago. We're still sort of a ways away from it now. And so, you know, he spent a lot of time talking about how much AOL Time Warner was going to accomplish. And, you know, there's nothing Wall Street hates more than being told you're going to do something and then not seeing you do it. The other thing I would say is, you know, in part, he's just a victim, I think, of the bursting of the internet bubble. and the fact that, you know, AOL's business no longer looks the way it did 2 years ago.
So what do you think? Are these three ousters some indication of what's going to happen in the future of the multinational media corporation?
Well, the one thing that's interesting about it is that, you know, most American media companies are actually, in a way, kind of throwbacks. They're actually run by people who effectively own those companies or control them to the point where there's no worry about getting dismissed. You know, if you think about Sumner Redstone at Viacom, Eisner at Disney, Rupert Murdoch at News Corp, technically an Australian company, but you know, obviously plays a huge role in the United States. I don't think that's going to change. But I do think that there is two things that are worth noting here. One is that, you know, CEOs are obviously, or COOs in Pittman's case, are being paid tremendous amounts of money. They're reaping great rewards, but they're also being held to certain standards. And, you know, if you don't perform to whatever standard the board of directors thinks you need to perform to, you'll be, you know, shown the door. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, it's good that people don't get a free ride. The second thing, which is potentially even more interesting, is that there may be a growing skepticism about this kind of empire building that has been so central to the media business.
Right. I mean, in the 90s, we really saw the celebration of the media mogul.
Yes.
They were practically movie stars. Do you think their day is passing?
Well, I do think in general you're seeing that in America, this kind of backlash against the exaltation of the CEO. And I think, you know, media moguls are obviously the epitome of that. So I think there's something of that.
Well, James, thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Surowiecki writes a regular financial column for The New Yorker. The media's current quiet obsession is not missing children or malfeasant magnates. It's how to mark the tragedy of September 11th, and just as important, how to pay for it. Networks are hard-pressed to find sponsors, and Fox has decided to drop ads altogether. This week, Wall Street Journal columnist Tanku Varadarajan conceded that when the networks dropped commercials in the days after the tragedy, it was consistent with, quote, the mood of the moment and the rapid rearrangement of priorities that followed the first taste of shock. But, he says, shrinking from commercials on the first anniversary would be, quote, purely and hollowly symbolic, even self-indulgent, even, he suggests, cowardly, motivated by a fear that ads would alienate consumers. Joining me now is TV Guide's Max Robbins. So, Max, what's the current thinking on the anniversary in TV land?
The networks all have extensive coverage planned. However, advertisers, by and large, don't really want to be a part of it. There's kind of a sense of they may be somehow exploiting the situation. That's the last thing any advertiser wants to be perceived as doing. It also, too, may be a business decision. There is going to be so much coverage that even if you prepared advertising really geared to the day and more in the sense of sponsorship, you'll still be lost in the clutter and emotion of the day.
It isn't just the advertisers. The networks themselves are shrinking from actually beating the bushes for advertisers.
The networks are being uncharacteristically sensitive on how they approach this, and they, too, don't want to appear like they're exploiting this. And there seems to be a collective sense of this is a day where we're not going to make money. And what they're looking for, as one network executive put it to me, will look a lot more like PBS than a commercially sponsored network.
Well, you know, that reminds me. Back in April, CBS had its own acclaimed documentary. It was called 9/11, and Nextel was the sponsor, but it didn't interrupt the show, and it didn't clobber us with the hard sell. It was more like a public broadcasting underwriting credit. Could that be a model for advertisers on the anniversary?
That very much is the model. And what sponsorship you will see will probably look very similar to what Nextel did with CBS's 9/11 documentary.
Good evening. I'm Tim Donahue, President and CEO of Nextel Communications. Welcome to this special presentation of 9/11. Tonight we'll see a remarkable film that captures the extraordinary bravery of the firefighters that fought desperately to save lives at the World Trade Center.
A major media buyer told me that this is a really polarizing issue, that you have about a third of the advertising community that says, we're not going to go near it. Another third that says, we want to step up, we're just not so sure how to do it. And then there's another third that is really kind of on the fence and wary, but not decisively out of the game.
What about advertising from Wall Street companies, the ones that suffered a direct and lingering impact from the attacks?
At CNN, there has been talk that there has been interest from some Wall Street firms. I think both the American Stock Exchange and the New York Stock Exchange have expressed some interest in doing some kind of a corporate sponsorship type advertising. I think there's another factor in this too, Brooke. Most of this business takes place in New York, those who would buy the time and those would sell it. And the people involved in this, by and large, were intimately involved in what happened. They may have lost loved ones. And somehow kind of mixing commerce in that makes some sort of a disconnect.
Well, Max, once again, thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure to be here, Brooke.
Max Robbins writes The Robbins Report for TV Guide.
Next month marks the 75th anniversary of the first television broadcast in the United States. It was an obscure event accomplished by a man who has an obscure place in history. Kate Rebelow presents the saga of Philo T. Farnsworth.
The next time you point the remote to turn on the tube, pause for a moment to ponder the machine itself and the man many claim was the first to bring it to life. In a new book, The Last Lone Inventor, author Evan Schwartz details the life of Philo T. Farnsworth, a Rigby, Idaho farm boy in love with radio, a 14-year-old kid who memorized Einstein's photoelectronic theory, a kid who instinctively knew that inventors trying to transmit moving pictures through spinning mechanical disks would fail. Schwartz says Farnsworth, a high school freshman in 1921, conceived modern television while engaged in the mind-numbing chore of plowing a potato field.
When he saw the parallel furrows in the field that he made, that was his eureka moment, that you had to scan a moving image line by line by line, transmit it, and then repaint the image line by line on a photosensitive surface, the television screen, and then you would have electronic television.
Farnsworth, shy and gangly, found his first backers at the age of 19. A $6,000 investment was parlayed into a $25,000 deal with California bankers. Farnsworth set up a laboratory in San Francisco with the devoted help of his 18-year-old wife, who kept detailed logs of all their experiments. An obsessed insomniac, Farnsworth gave himself problems to solve before going to bed. Shortly after his 21st birthday, he hit pay dirt.
It took about a year, just as he promised his backers, and on September 7th, 1927, was the first line. It was just a line of blue light that went through the whole system, and it was received on that reception tube. And at that moment, he said, "There you have it, folks, electronic television."
There is general agreement that Farnsworth never received the credit he deserved. But there are those who say the young inventor sabotaged himself by clinging to the romantic notion that his genius should be and would be enough to bring television to life. The world changed while Farnsworth toiled in his lab. Earlier inventions by Edison and Bell spawned ever-growing huge corporations better suited to bringing innovation to the marketplace. In particular, Farnsworth was up against RCA's David Sarnoff, the headline-seeking king of radio, who saw himself as the person who would take broadcasting to its next zenith. TV historian Tom Genova says Sarnoff was driven to build up his reputation, even if he had to bend the truth.
In the early days, there's a couple stories about the fact that he claimed to be the sole telegraph operator and gathering the news reports and the sinking of the Titanic in 1912. Well, in reality, he was not the sole operator. There were other operators. But he used this story, which he told over and over again, to enhance his credibility and to gain a reputation.
Farnsworth could never match Sarnoff's financial and political clout. The only thing that kept the inventor from financial ruin and total obscurity was his decision to hire a bright patent attorney. In 1928, Sarnoff made his own key hire, a Russian scientist who was secretly charged with the task of developing a television system for RCA. That scientist visited Farnsworth, ultimately prompting the inventor to successfully sue RCA for patent infringement. In 1931, Sarnoff himself visited Farnsworth's Green Street lab, offering a paltry $100,000 for the equipment and the intellectual property. Farnsworth was out of town at the time and summarily turned the offer down. the two men never met. Though there is no evidence Sarnoff bore the inventor any personal ill will, there would be no sharing of the spotlight. Sarnoff pulled off his biggest PR coup at the 1939 World's Fair in New York City, before the standards for television had even been adopted. Author Evan Schwartz.
Sarnoff knew instinctively that television had to debut at the fair. He saw that the theme of the fair was the world of tomorrow, building the future, and he built the sprawling television pavilion, and that's when he had his famous quote, "We are now adding sight to sound." And he introduced Franklin D. Roosevelt, the first president televised. He had the stature to get press attention far and wide, and from then on, the world credited that day as the birth of television.
RCA eventually struck a deal to license Farnsworth's technology, but the victory was bittersweet. All work on television ground to a halt as World War II approached. Sarnoff's stature kept growing as Farnsworth realized his controlling patents would expire before his vision of television would be realized. The death of his dream sent Farnsworth into a deep depression. He started drinking during the day. He unwittingly got hooked on a highly addictive sedative. He was hospitalized in 1940.
He expected a lot more from people than they could give. And I guess that he expected so much of himself, too.
Laura Player is Farnsworth's younger sister.
Phil was very disappointed when television came on. He thought it was a lofty thing, a thing that should be for learning. Great things were going to be learned and shared by countries. It was going to be a melding place for the whole world. And it was all of these things. But when Phil saw some of the things, he thought, it's a waste of time, you know. And it still is.
Farnsworth eventually turned his attention to fusion and other inventions. His 8-year-old son was the only kid at school who had to beg to have a working TV at home. Farnsworth's most public recognition came in 1957. He was a mystery guest on the television show I've Got a Secret.
This is the famous Dr. Philo T. Farnsworth, who invented electronic television.
Henry. Doctor, truthfully, are you sorry?
No. I'm not.
Well, it's up to you.
I asked him the same question. He said sometimes.
Farnsworth won $80 and a carton of Winston cigarettes for his appearance.
Dr. Farnsworth, we could sit here for many, many hours and talk. Most fascinating man I've met in many a long year. But unfortunately, television being what it is, it's your baby and we're out of time. So here are your Winston, sir, the money that you won, and our eternal gratitude. I'd be out of work if it weren't for you. Thank you very much.
Philo Farnsworth died in 1971 at the age of 64. Isolated from the world of business and science. Only a handful of family and friends attended his funeral. Today, a simple plaque on the corner of Green and Sansom Streets in San Francisco marks a spot where he performed his magic. For On the Media, this is Chris Rebolo in San Francisco.
Coming up, why TV wrestling is going stone cold and why The Thing of comic book fame is now and forever Jewish.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Since the Hulk Hogan era of the 1980s, pro wrestling, led by Vince McMahon's World Wrestling Entertainment, formerly the World Wrestling Federation, has been synonymous with mega entertainment,
Rowdy fans have filled arenas across the country to see Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock toss their steroid-pumped opponents around the ring.
Wait a minute. Is The Undertaker turning his back on his tag partner?
TV wrestling shows like UPN's SmackDown and TNN's Monday Night Raw seemed to have a chokehold on prime time, but in recent months it appears pro wrestling is losing some of its appeal. SmackDown ratings have plummeted, and arena audiences are also hitting the mat. Reporter Paul Fahey chronicled the decline in a recent article for The Washington Post. Paul, welcome back to OTM.
Hi, Bob.
Start by, please, giving me a little bit of background. Professional wrestling has been around since the beginnings of TV, and it seems to me moved along at a steady pace for decades. There were a certain number of people who were attracted to with the spectacle, and a much larger percentage of the TV audience who just rolled their eyes. But then something turned. When and how and why?
Well, I think what happened was Vince McMahon happened. Vince McMahon was the first one really to say, let's get rid of this pretext of whether it's real or not. He came right out and said, it's fake. Now wrestling embraced what it had always been before, but added these great moments of theatrical drama, these stories, the soap opera that it became.
And it flourished for a decade, but seems to have hit the wall. What's going on?
It seems to be losing the most important viewers and fans of all, that is 14-year-old boys. And if you lose 14-year-old boys, eventually you lose 24-year-old boys and 34-year-old boys. It's something like smoking. If you don't hook them by the age of 14, you lose the customer. And that seems to be what's happening now. Wrestling is just uncool. Maybe the stories have gotten stale. They've been hurt by the absence of The Rock, who's making movies now and doing quite well at it, and the petering out, I guess, of Stone Cold Steve Austin, who was the big figure of the 1990s.
I'm curious to know where the 14-year-old boys have gone. I gather they're not renting Merchant Ivory movies and, watching them over popcorn and orange soda.
14-year-old boys have gone where the other networks have lured them, to shows like Fear Factor and Dog Eat Dog. 14-year-old boys like the gross, they like the violent, they like the sexual, and the whole reality genre has taken away a lot of that audience.
In your story in the Post, you said that there have been scenes of wrestlers urinating on one another, or at least simulating that, and eating their own vomit. Has it really gotten that bad?
Yes, it has gotten that bad. It's always been bad. But there's a certain desperation, I guess you'd say, that's creeping into it.
Tell me about Tough Enough, the MTV program. How does that fit into this whole ecosystem?
I think Tough Enough is ultimately the most important piece of the puzzle for the WWE. Tough Enough is a show in which would-be wrestling superstars try out for the sport and attempt to make the big time. It's about taking some of the elements of the reality shows that have taken away wrestling's audience and trying to reclaim them with a kind of show that might actually lead people to watch the main event.
Well, Paul, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Paul Fahey is a reporter for the Style section of the Washington Post.
If wrestling is indeed a passing obsession for the nation's youth, let's move on to a more durable one, comic book superheroes. Remember the Thing, the crime fighter made of stone from the Fantastic Four? Well, he's Jewish. Marvel Comics revealed that detail this summer in Volume 56 titled Remembrances of Things Past. Apologies to Proust. The Thing was born Benjamin Jacob Grimm, and before the encounter with cosmic rays that transformed him into an ugly but lovably heroic piece of rock, he was working his way through life in New York City's Lower East Side. The Thing has been a part of the Marvel Comics universe since 1961. So why are we just finding out he's Jewish? Fantastic Four editor Tom Brevoort joins me to answer that question. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
So, the Thing is Jewish?
Yes, the Thing is Jewish.
How do you know?
The Thing is Jewish, and one of the reasons we know this, or one of the reasons we believe this, it's always sort of been a tenet of the Marvel characters that they're more fully formed, more fully realized, more real, more true to life than other comic book superheroes. That's always been the case going back to the birth of the Marvel Universe in 1961, that what Stan Lee and Jack Kirby did then was create characters that had feet of clay and dealt with ordinary human problems. They had to deal with paying the rent and soap opera-esque romantic difficulties in addition to catching the bad guys. And Stan Lee and Jack Kirby drew a lot from their own backgrounds. In the case of Jack, who was born Jacob Kurtzberg, in his home, over his hearth, he had done just for himself and his family a drawing of the Thing in a full rabbinical uniform with yarmulke and so forth. The Thing draws a lot of the particulars of his background from Kirby's. So it seemed like a fairly natural extension, particularly having become aware of this piece that Kirby had done, to believe, okay, the Thing is Jewish, and at least one of his two co-creators had that in the back of his mind.
Well, there is one Jewish archetype to which
yes.
the Thing seems to conform, and that is of the Golem, the man made of earth to protect the Jewish people in the ghetto.
It's definitely a parallel, and it's something that we even pointed out in the course of that issue of Fantastic Four. Whether or not there was anything specific there that Stan and Jack were thinking, you know, only Stan or Jack, who himself has passed away, could answer that for certain. But there's definitely an interesting parallel there, and it only kind of helps to support the argument.
But why the Thing? Why not Spider-Man? Or as John Stewart likes to call him, Spider-Man.
Well, there's no specific evidence either way to indicate whether Peter Parker is Jewish or not. We've never really seen anything that indicates a particular religious bent in his case.
But it was that drawing of Jack Kirby that inspired you to ascribe that religious identity to the Thing.
It was specifically that. Other creators over the course of years have somewhat intimated it. The Thing's full given name is Benjamin Jacob Grimm, which has a Jewish flavor to it. The way his home life in his pre-Thing days had been depicted had sort of the flavor of a typical Jewish immigrant family without ever actually coming out and saying so.
Mm-hmm.
And so the elements were all there, and it may have been that in times where what was allowable in a comic magazine, what was considered acceptable subject matter to be dealt with, wasn't as permissive as it is today. Various creators wanted to ascribe these tendencies to the character and just could go only so far in depicting this world or depicting this background.
But I still don't understand why. Do you think that it'll bump up sales? I mean, do you think that saying the Shema in one of the later panels will attract a new group of readers?
It wasn't intended at all as a sales ploy. If it had been, we would have talked about it a lot more before the book came out rather than afterwards. All of the stories that we tell in the course of Marvel Comics combine fantasy with reality. So the goal specifically wasn't let's do a story where the Thing is Jewish. It was let's do a story about this character and where he comes from and the events and the circumstances that made him what he is, not just as the big rocky powerhouse the Thing, but what made him Ben Grimm the man before he became the Thing.
Do you plan to endow any other Marvel superheroes with spiritual identities, like make Storm Amish?
I don't think Storm will be coming Amish anytime soon, but Marvel characters come from all walks, all cultural backgrounds, all countries. And so it's not like this is something that's new that we're doing for the first time. It's, I guess, a little more significant in that this is a character that's been around for 40 years and an element to his background that really hasn't been discussed or addressed before. I don't know that this will be a specific trend any more than just trying to tell stories that somehow touch on the human condition and that people can relate to beyond just punching and hitting and chasing the bad guy.
As you explained, Jack Kirby gave you some indication through that drawing before he died that probably the Thing was Jewish. And, of course, he drew the Thing.
Right.
Stan Lee wrote the Thing. Did you ever talk to him? What do you think he thinks about all this?
We never spoke to Stan about this, largely because, as I say, doing the story, we didn't think it was as big a deal as it seems to be. In the case of Stan and what he was thinking about this way back when and what he thinks of it now, I can't speak for Stan. I guess you'd have to speak to him directly.
Okay. Tom Brevoort is an editor at Marvel Comics. Fantastic Four is just one of his charges. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Stan Lee, creator of Spider-Man, the Silver Surfer, the Fantastic Four, including the Thing, and many, many other characters. Stan, welcome to OTM.
Well, it's good to be here.
Okay, first off, the Thing. He doesn't look Jewish.
You know, I didn't intend for him to be Jewish. I wrote the Fantastic Four for the first 100 issues or so, and then years ago, I gave it up. And there have been many, many writers who did it after I had left the series. So recently, one of them decided to make Ben Grimm Jewish, which is fine. The reason I didn't, I never made any of the characters of any specific ethnicity or religion, because I wanted them to be enjoyed by people all around the world of varying faiths and so forth. And I tried to keep everything kind of neutral. But I guess the guys thought it might be fun to make them Jewish, and that's fine with me.
Is it possible that somewhere, deep in the back of your mind, in the hidden recesses of your consciousness, you knew that Ben Grimm was Jewish all along, that he, the thing, this rock being, is a golem? Or is he just
a
thing?
No, I wanted to write four superheroes. One was a girl, one was a handsome guy, one was a teenager, and I wanted the fourth one to be something different. And it occurred to me I would try to make him sort of a tragic figure. I would turn this guy into somebody ugly. I never thought for a minute what their religions were.
Now, there have been some explicitly Jewish characters in the history of comics.
Mm-hmm.
Izzy Cohen
mm-hmm.
Was a character in Sergeant Fury's Commandos.
Right.
X-Force had a character named Bermuda Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of my favorites, actually, I just ran across them. Hadn't hitherto known that there was a Greenberg the Vampire and Shapiro Man. Am I missing any big ones?
Well, Greenberg the Vampire is very funny. I had never heard of Bermuda Schwartz, but I think that's hysterical. Izzy Cohen was a character I created for Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos, which was a World War II series about a platoon headed by Sergeant Fury. I wanted him to have a multi-ethnic platoon, so he had Izzy Cohen, he had a black man named Gabriel Jones, he had a gay man named Percival Pinkerton. He had an Italian, Dino Minnelli, and so forth. I mean, it wasn't an effort to play up a Jew. It was just an effort to play up all the various racial types.
Jewish culture is nonetheless a rich vein in the comics world. You and artist Jack Kirby, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster of Superman fame, Julius
Bob
Schwartz.
Bob Kane, Batman.
Bob Kane. How did this come to pass? And how much has Jewishness, do you think, informed the medium?
You know, I have no idea. I never really thought of it. And it seems to me, I'm sure there are plenty of people who aren't Jewish in the field, but it is strange when you mention it that perhaps the best known of all the characters, Spider-Man, Superman, and Batman, were done by Jewish writers. I guess that is an odd thought.
Superman seems to be loosely based on the story of Moses. The boy on the planet Krypton, the infant's name was Kal-El, which I believe means something like the vessel of God. And Superman was sent by his parents to be saved from extermination, as Moses was down the Nile, and only to be a force of good versus evil in his new life. I'm sure you've noticed the parallel.
You
Do you
know,
think readers
I
notice
haven't.
These parallels?
This is the first I've heard of it. Now that you mention it, it does sound like there's a parallel, but no, it never, never occurred to me until this very moment.
Back on the Marvel Comics side, X-Men are said to be somehow archetypes of the American Jewish experience, admired for their gifts, but viewed with suspicion by outsiders and maybe even fear. Does that scan with you?
Well, when I started the X-Men, I did, after a while, decide that it made a good metaphor for bigotry and the ills of hating people who are different than you. Again, I personally did not think of it in terms of Jewishness. It just seemed like a good theme to use for the X-Men.
Well, how about bigotry? And I'm not trying to be a smart aleck here, but I noticed that both you and Jack Kirby de-Judified your pen names.
Mm-hmm.
You were
I can't
Stan
speak
Lieber.
For Jack. I have no way of knowing why he did it. I did not attempt to de-Jewify it. My name was Stanley Martin Lieber, which I think is a beautiful name. I'm very sorry I changed it. The reason I changed it was when I went into the comic business, nobody had any respect for comics in those days. I was embarrassed to be doing comics, and I didn't want to use my real name for the comics. And I never expected to stay in the field more than a short time to get some experience and then get out in the real world. What happened was I remained in comics. I built my whole career in comics. And after a while, life was too confusing. More people knew me as Stan Lee, which was the name I used to write the comics, than they did as Stanley Lieber.
Well, listen, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, it was a pleasure for me, too. I hope I didn't spoil your whole show.
Not at all.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Stan Lee is the creator of Ben Grimm, The Thing, and chairman emeritus of Marvel Comics.
The Fantastic Four, starring Reed Richards, Stu Richards, Johnny Storm, Ben Grimm. Reed Richards with his power to stretch. The Thing with the strength of 1,000 men. Johnny, flame on, torch. And Sue, the Invisible Girl. The Fantastic Four, united in their fight against interplanetary evil. Fantastic.
As Galacticus hatches a plot to enslave the universe, Ben Grimm, the Thing, stirs from his slumber. He can feel the force of evil vibrating in his granite musculature. And he is getting a message from far away.
Benny! Benjamin! It's your mother.
Impossible. You died when I was a child. I was raised by Uncle Jake and Aunt Petunia.
Excuse me. You took a rocket into deep space and got yourself transformed by cosmic radiation into a Fakakta metamorphic mesomorph, and you don't think your own mother can talk to you from beyond? And by the way, you look a little jaundiced. Have you been eating leafy vegetables?
Ma, I'm a mutant. I'm orange.
Listen to the big shot talk to his mother, Mr. Superhero with a Shiksa girlfriend. To the Mole Man, you wouldn't take this tone. Or Dr. Doom, who, by the way, has made something of himself. I always told you, podiatry, it's a gold mine.
Mom, I gotta go. Galacticus is wreaking havoc on the universe, and it's clobbering time.
All right, Thal. Bundle up.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis and Megan Ryan, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Weisberg, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Rex Doan and Dan Bobkoff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Jewish, and I'm Bob Garfield.
Also Jewish.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.